It's Friday, the 13th of October, and it's Steve Haig and Jim Pakula interviewing Dr. Alan A. McRae in his office at Biblical Seminary. And he's just shared with us an anecdote about another Friday the 13th in which he climbed the highest mountain in Great Britain and went to the hotel, had room 13, had table 13 in the dining room, had the knob come off the inside of his door so he couldn't get down to the dining room, had the people walk into the building as he was trying to beckon them from the window, and eventually pried the door open with something. So, Dr. McRae, you're not superstitious, but you may have reason to be just a little bit after that.
Okay.
Well, it's been suggested that we start, say, 60 years ago. 60 years ago this year, I had finished 2 years study in Berlin. During those 2 years, I had many, many interesting experiences, but they are not specifically directly connected with our story, so I'll move on to the next 8 years. Now, those 8 years, the first three of them were among the happiest years of my life. Oh, wonderful fellowship among the faculty and the wonderful group of students we had. Eyes on the Lord, anxious to serve Him, anxious to learn, so anxious to learn that when I, as a beginning teacher, not knowing much about what I had a right to require, told the students, if you're going to learn Hebrew, you'll have to spend 4 hours for each class of study. And I don't care how stupid you are, if you put in 4 hours of class, you learn. I don't care how bright you are, if you don't, you won't get it well enough. And the students did what I said, and the other faculty members did. So he said, our students aren't doing any work. That's when all their time on And Dr. Machen said, if they put all that much time on Hebrew, how are they going to learn any Greek? Well, Dr. Stolz didn't require 4 hours for his. I soon got over that because I learned a little bit about it. Well, I learned an awful lot because when you start teaching, if you don't have much instruction in teaching, you have to kind of feel your way.
Sure.
And I felt my way in the Lord enabled me to get over some of the rough points and at the same time to learn a few things that were very effective. Well, as I say, the first 3 years, oh, they were wonderful years. But there was a gradual change there during 8 years. The first 3 years I was there, I say, were the happiest, among the very happiest of my life. The last 3 years there were the least happy in my life. And there was this gradual change, which I did not sense. I began to sense it about 3 or 4 years before. The first 3 years when I would visit the family, I was just brimming over with joy. The last 3 years, I said, I just feel my life being utterly wasted. Just not accomplishing anything. And the reason was the central factor in it was Dr. Van Til. Dr. Machen was out trying to propagandize against liberalism, doing a great job of that. And he would come into school and he would teach his classes excellently, and then he'd be off to Chicago to a meeting or somewhere and doing a very fine work that way. But the only contact we had with him was on Saturdays when we had the faculty meetings. And those faculty meetings were a learning period because the faculty had been disgusted with the way the president of Princeton Seminary had utilized his influence and power to completely change the place. And they didn't want to have a president. So Dr. Machen was just president, chairman of the faculty, the no president. And everything that had to come before the faculty was discussed at great length. We have a question we might spend 4 Saturday mornings discussing it. But you learn a lot. And it was preparation for me for starting seminaries later on. So it was valuable for me. But it took endless time to decide most anything. I learned the attitude of other faculty members. I learned there, of course. Now, a great many of our students came from Wheaton College, and Dr. Buswell, president of Wheaton College, was working hard to get students to come to us. And they were mostly under his influence. They were fine, godly fellows. And the ones who came from elsewhere came because they wanted what we had there to give them. And I didn't realize how they were gradually changing because, of course, my teaching was largely first year at first. Well, the second year, Dr. Alice suddenly died. Dr. Wilson suddenly died after less than 2 weeks had gone. And Dr. Alice came to me and said, Dr. Machen is teaching two lecture courses. He said, you take one and I'll take the other one. Well, I had already announced and elected for that fall, which I've been working intensively on. Now to have this course on top of that, my nose was pretty close to the grindstone. And then in addition to that, when I first reached there, Dr. Wilson said to me, now he said, you've done this work in Germany. He said, where are you going to continue study? His attitude was quite different from Dr. Alice, as I found later. Dr. Alice later at one time said, when somebody, they announced we have 8 faculty members, he said, is that honest for us to say we have 8? Because Dr. McCray, or Mr. McCray, is taking work at the University of Pennsylvania. Is he really a full-time teacher? Well, I was teaching more hours than perhaps any other 2 members of the faculty together, so I think I was fully doing my work there. But Wilson's attitude was, I want you to get ahead. One thing about Wilson that was, I think, very unfortunate is he said to me, he says, I know what you'll be doing. He says, you'll be standing up at the General Assembly making a talk, he says, and you'll be getting books and magazine articles out before you're half ready. He says, wait until you're really ready. I can't blame him for the fact that I waited too long. I should have started publishing much, much earlier than I did. In fact, all through my life, I've mostly only written what I've been asked. And I should instead show more initiative in that regard. That's where Joe Young got ahead of me. Because Joe Young, even when he was in a student, he wrote a brief commentary on Genesis, which Erdman's called Know the Bible Commentary. And the first volume was Genesis. They never wrote another one, published another one. But they published that for him when he was just a student there at Westminster, and it was mostly made up of what he'd gotten in Dr. Alice's classes in the Old Testament. And it probably did good, but it started Young on a course of publishing, which he started too early. I waited too late. I didn't realize what was happening, but Dr. Van Til was having a greater and greater influence among the students. The first I really realized, though, the things that were coming in was when, I think I mentioned before once, a student there, I think it was my second year, and there was Atkinson, young Atkinson, I forget his first name. He had graduated from the seminary, and he had a church down near, in Benton, near Atlantic City. And he was coming up to take graduate work. He was a fine speaker and a good evangelist and a very, very godly fellow. But one day he said to me, he says, I've always said, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. I said, I can't say that anymore since I'm taking Kuyper's course in doctrinal preaching. He says, I can't say that anymore because he says, we have no right to say that. He says, they will come if the Lord is elected. We can't give them a false idea they might be elected if they're not. He says, we just can't say that. And here this fellow was just losing his zeal and everything. And as it gradually went on, the thing was to be zealous for the Reformed faith. That was the thing, rather than to win souls for Christ. I've always felt that the Reformed faith and the specific teachings of Calvinism are a most wonderful blessing for us. For give us assurance and confidence and knowledge that we can trust in the Lord, and we didn't choose Him, He chose us. It's wonderful for the Christian, but it's not for the unbeliever. John Murray had the most wonderful idea. He used to say in his sermons, he was an energetic preacher, very effective, but in his sermons he would say, now you look upstream, and as you look upstream, you see where you came from, he says, you see that the Lord's hand was on me all along, that the Lord brought me to the Lord, that it's purely His grace that I'm here. But he says, as you're upstream, you look down, and you see, come unto me, all ye that labor, come unto me, and I will give you rest, and you see the Lord calling, and you respond to His call. And he said, there are the two sides. Well, the one thus for the believer is a marvelous blessing of giving you confidence and trust. And we are doing people a favor and giving them understanding of the Reformed faith. But it's not a thing to divide Christians and to make fighting over, and not a thing to be the main thing. The main thing is to be the servant of the Lord in reaching people for Christ and helping them to grow in grace. And John Murray was doing that, definitely. But the attitude of Kuyper, particularly, and of Van Til, and Stoness, I think, was these men must be on fire to go out and stand for the Reformed faith. And they gradually developed that in the streets. Now, I think maybe I should take a break right now. Is that nearly 20 minutes or not?
Not quite.
Well, I'll go on a little further then. This was developing, and I didn't see it for two reasons. One, of course, was I had the heaviest schedule of anybody there. And I took on elective stress more than I should. But another was I had more contact with the students during the first couple of years, but then I ate with them. And after John Murray came, he lived in the Gladstone Hotel where most of the students lived. And he had much more contact than I did after that. And he and I would eat our meals together. The other thing was, of course, that Dr. Wilson encouraged me to go ahead and take courses, and I took. You could walk out from the place where we had our classes, walk a block, get on a trolley car, and in 6 or 7 minutes I was at the University of Pennsylvania. So it was so easy to reach it and have contact, and the tuition was very, very low at that time, and I took a heavy schedule of courses there. And so, as I say, I was the faculty advisor to the students, student council had asked me to serve in that capacity, and I was that for 3 or 4 years, and then somebody in the faculty said, why do the students pick their faculty advisor? That should be the faculty. So they got the student constitution and went all through it and changed it around and made it that the faculty appoints the advisor. And Dr. Machen said, he says, that should be the faculty doing. And he says, it's fine, the students want Mr. McCrae for the advisor. And he says, we couldn't find a better man than McCrae for this, so we'll elect him. So I was faculty advisor to students the whole time, but partly by older students, partly by older of the faculty. But that took a little more time, too. And, of course, there was getting alumni meetings arranged and that sort of thing. It was mostly sort of type of things. Well, now, while during those years, there was Dr. Machen was very, very interested in opposing modernism, which we all were doing constantly. But he was anxious to see what he could do to change the church. And the best thing he could have done to change the church was to train a lot of new ministers. And of course we were doing that. And they were getting received. We were active in the presbytery meetings. All the factors who were Presbyterians were active in the presbytery, and I was sort of on, you might say, on the edge of it. I saw what Machen was doing. I went to the presbytery meetings. I come home from those meetings where the modernists would make such a fuss, and I just could hardly sit still. I was so nervous after going through them. And they met, I think, 10 times a year with Philip the Presbytery at that time. So it was a strain. But and then when we would ordain one of our students, we would have a meeting to ordain him. It's a meeting of presbytery, of course. And we would have some of the strong evangelical members of the presbytery performing the different functions, including some of our faculty, and the modernists would always have one or two of them come to the meeting. They were suspicious of what we might do. As a regular presbytery meeting, you could do what you wanted, even though called for this specific purpose. Then when, of course, we had to keep track of what was happening. But we were well received, and our students were well received. But then the issue of the foreign mission board came up. One thing that brought that to our attention was that when our students would go before the board of missions in New York, they liked their doctrine, they liked their ability, they liked their training, but they were afraid they would make trouble on the mission field. And in fact, at that time, a fellow I had known in Occidental wrote a letter to somebody. And he said, I'm here in Calcutta, in India, and in our section of India, we have 60 missionaries, I think. Maybe a 30, I think it was 60 though. He says, one of them is giving half his time to evangelism. All the rest are working in educational work, agricultural work, other things like that. And then Dr. Barnhaus made a trip around the world. And one of the few evangelical missionaries in that group in India sent us a copy of the letter that the president of the group sent around to all the missionaries. And it said, Dr. Barnhaus has been here and gone. Now we can put our Bibles up on the shelf. We don't have to keep them on the table anymore. And he went on, you know, giving the impression that they'd all been putting on a front in order to make Barnhaus think they were really evangelical. And you felt what was happening in the mission field. And then one of our students would come up before the board, and of one of them, they said, well, he says, he's a fine fellow, very able. And they said, but they said the only place where he could work without making trouble among the missionaries would be in some parts of Korea. So they said, it's a question whether we ought to send him. Well, our students would come back from a meeting with the board, and they would be more and more aroused on account of the modernists than they'd been even before they went. And Dr. Machen decided we've got to start a new board so that our students can be sent. And so he formed the board. And he got some of the finest ministers, heads of the leading churches in the country to be on the board, and laymen, and they spend hours working their plans to go to new fields. And it was a great move. Well, it's on. Good. One thing that should be mentioned, the students from Wheaton were, I think, all premillennial when they came. Wheaton was definitely premillennial. And Dr. Robert Dick Wilson used to say, I'm not a premillennialist, I'm not a postmillennialist, I'm not an amillennialist, I'm a millennialist. And what he meant by that was that the little details of differences, wasn't interested in, because he was interested in the big thing of standing for the faith and presenting the gospel and knowing that God's plan would work out the way God wanted it. And that, to me, was an excellent attitude. But Dr. Alice got on a binge against premillennialism. Though he called it dispensationalism, he said, I nothing against a premillennialist, he says, unless he's a dispensationalist. But what he meant by dispensationalist, he never made clear altogether. I thought some of his arguments were very, very petty. I was told that in his class in Old Testament Introduction, he had spent half the semester discussing the statement in Acts where James quotes from Amos discussing the meaning of it. And I see how the thing came to be that way. Dr. Alice was tremendously interested in the defense of the Bible, defense of the Old Testament against its opponents. And he did wonderful work in that, and he wrote some very good books. But he would get in a class, and these students, many of them from Wheaton, and the bulk of them from premillennial backgrounds, he would be giving this material to defend the Bible, and they all believed in the Bible, and they sounded to them as if these ideas of the critics were very foolish anyway. So there wasn't much interest, really. I learned from that. When I taught, I presented the views of the critics the way they would do it. Fellows, once they said to my wife, they says, we're just praying Dr. McRae won't die over the weekend because he's presented the arguments for the second Isaiah, and we know he doesn't believe in it. But if he died over the weekend, we'd never hear the answer to him. Well, I took time to have them know what the critics said and see the strength of their arguments, and then went ahead to demolish them. Well, Dr. Alice and Dr. Wilson proceeded to demolish them without most of the students knowing what they were. And the students knew they didn't believe this junk anyway, so they weren't greatly interested, and he got no reaction much. But when he would criticize premillennialism, the students would wake up and would start raising questions, so that stimulated him to spend more and more time in the classes on that instead of on the basic thing which he was so good at and had the material and everything. And that was unfortunate. But the students then, between Dr. Alice and Stonehouse and John Murray, they would change and give up any premillennialist ideas. And then when these men, some of them were just in their classes. Yes, thanks for calling attention back to that. Dr. Machen, in founding the independent board, got men who stood strongly for the Word of God, and at least two out of three of them were premillennialists. And so the two tied together, you see, because they were urging them to support and help and work on this, and at the same time, these other men were taking the students that came from their churches and held those views and making them think the views were utter nonsense. And if you took Machen's, Machen didn't go into it. And many, he taught electives on various books, and it didn't enter into his field at all. So the erroneous idea got around that Machen was an amillennialist. And Machen was the very opposite of an amillennialist. He was a postmillennialist. He said, I do not feel sure, as Dr. Warfield was, that when Christ comes back, every man, woman, and child on earth will be a Christian. But he said, I do feel that the gospel is going to make a much wider impact before he comes than it has as yet. Well, of course, that cut at the root of both all-millennialism and pre-millennialism, both of them. But the all-millennialists didn't realize that. They will claim he was an all-millennialist. Actually, he didn't go into it. And some of us were hoping, he was going through the New Testament with electors, and we were hoping he would get to Revelation, because he was so honest in his methods and so careful that he certainly would have been a pre-millennialist if he had taught the book of Revelation. But he didn't get that far before he died. But these were the real thing that brought on, of course, the troubles was the independent board, because the modernists got the idea that the independent board was going to take 3/4 of the mission money from the country, and they didn't want that to happen. So this really got them on fire all over. Before that, they were gaining, their modernist seminaries were making more graduates than anybody else, and they were getting good churches and having more influence, and they weren't particularly concerned, not at least not worried. But when began to threaten the independent, regular board's control, and they got the impression millions of dollars would be lost to the regular board and go to the independent board. So that's when the attack started. And but in the seminary, they were attacking modernism some, but they were attacking premillennialism, and they were attacking some of them the way Kuyper and Van Til and others did. It, in the minds of the students, gave the impression, which they didn't mean at all, that evangelism is rather foolish. Because after all, well, as one fellow said, he says, I like Arminian preaching, he says, because he says, it's more fiery, more energetic, he says, I like Arminian preaching. Well, somebody said, Arminian preaching glorifies man. Calvinist preaching glorifies God. Well, of course, that's not true at all. It doesn't enter into it. We know that God controls all things, but we also know that he's called upon us to call people to the Lord. And the idea that they were more excited about getting people to believe in the limited atonement than they were in getting to know the Lord. And one day, we were asked, somebody wrote, I think I've already mentioned this once, somebody wrote a letter asking about the, he was a good supporter of the seminary, sent us students and sent us money, and he wrote and said, I have heard that you teach the limited atonement there. He said, is this true? Well, they had about 4 meetings of faculty that discussed it. And in the end, Dr. Kuyper wrote the statement, and the statement was that the atonement, it was an old Calvinistic standard statement, that the atonement is sufficient for all, but efficient for the elect. Well, nobody can object to that, of course. Nobody that believes in that God is supreme can object to that. It's sufficient for all. Well, nothing's limited about it. It's sufficient for all, and God knows who he's going to bring influences into their lives, and going to lead them, and going to bring them to the Lord, and who will ultimately be saved. But
trash?
Yeah. Of course, the big thing, the attack came from the independent board. And the General Assembly went at it 1 year, the next year, and the next year. And they went at it very carefully, and they took an action which in the end said that, well, when it became clear that the independent board was under strong attack, half its members resigned. And so they had to look for people who were willing to take this attack. And they got some of the young ministers, like Dr. McIntyre, who was, they invited him to come on the board to take the place of Dr. Buchanan, pastor of the big church up in New York, who had just died 2 months before. Well, when he got on, he found that there were six or seven pastors of big churches who had recently resigned. But they announced he was taking the place of Dr. Buchanan, you see. Well, when the independent board was attacked, when the attack began, Dr. Machen and others organized the Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union, which was to be Presbyterians who wanted fair play in the councils of the church for Christianity and wanted the gospel to maintain the part which, according to the standards of the church, it should have. But then when the attack came, the students became very, very critical of Dr. Machen. And Dr. Machen's, because Dr. Machen was active in this, and there were Presbyterians, I mean, there were premillennials, and in fact, the people who really would stand were largely premillennials. And he was working with these premillennials and even working with some who had Arminian tendencies, so on. Well, Dr. Machen said to me, he says, why don't they come into the meetings of the Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union and make strong speeches about the Reformed faith and urge people to believe it? But he says, when we're trying to make a stand for the gospel, for them to criticize me this way, they began criticizing Carl McIntyre. And Carl had a brother, Blair, who was in the... was a student. And Blair said to me, he says, I can just see as the students look at me, see the hatred because I'm the brother of Carl McIntyre. He was not Dr. McIntyre yet then. And there was this tremendous feeling. Well, of course, they never talked directly to me about this. But I, you know, heard about this way and that and got an idea of what was developing. And for two or three of my last years there, I would say to my mother, you know, I think these years are just being utterly wasted. I'm just not accomplishing. And then a new element came in, and that was that these Dutchmen were very strong on the right of a person to smoke tobacco. And Dr. Machen never smoked and never drank, but he did love to buy cigars for other people. And so at the meetings of the faculty, we would go over and eat dinner at a big hotel near there. And then when we finished, he would come around and hand everybody cigars, as he would buy, as everybody that smoked. And one time we had Dr. Laird, who was a member of the independent board and a member of the secretary of the board of the seminary, and he was the speaker of the day of prayer, and gave a marvelous message. And after they invited him to eat with the faculty, and they did, and Dr. Machen didn't buy any cigars. And at our next meeting, next week, Dr. Machen mentioned, he says, I'm sorry not to have gotten you into cigars, but he says, I thought with Dr. Laird, our guest is probably better I don't. Dr. Stonehouse says, he says, I don't know, but when he was there, it was our duty to smoke. Well, you see, he meant it was their duty to stand for the principle of your right to smoke if you wanted to. And when he was in Holland, he told me, studying there, Professor Hepp used to invite all the American students to his house for dinner or for an evening, one evening a week. They invite all the American students, and he would just go around and have a cigar, have a cigar, have a cigarette, so on. And he was just urging people. And Stoner says, I wasn't going to have anybody forcing me to smoke. So he said, I never touched the tobacco in his house. But he was determined on his right to smoke and his duty to show Laird, Dr. Laird, you see.
Mm.
Well, the students who had graduated, some of them who graduated from Wheaton, where smoking was strictly forbidden, and they were taking up smoking. And people outside were asking, is the seminary against premillennialism? And people say, why, no, we have two premillennialists on the faculty. We don't take a stand for or against premillennialism. Well, the two were, Paul William taught church history and never mentioned it in his classes. And I, who was teaching beginning Hebrew and Old Testament criticism. The result was that in their classes, they were attacking it, and these fellows, who Dr. Boswell was sending to us with great effort, often, they would come, and after a year or two, they looked on him and the Wheaton faculty as old fogies with crazy ideas, and they looked down on them. And you can imagine what an impression that made, and what an attitude that made them hesitate about whether they should keep sending so many students there.
Well, I've heard the use of the term Christian liberties conflict in Westminster.
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to? Is that what they call that, the Christian liberties conflict or something?
They may call it that, yeah. But it was there insisting on the importance of smoking. You know, I don't think the greatest sin in the world is either smoking or drinking alcohol. I do think that when most of the Christians at that time, the stand against alcohol was a major thing among all the fundamentalist Christians then. I don't see any reason to oppose and turn those people against us by taking a stance on our liberty to wreck our bodies and to help that which results in all kinds of deaths on the highway. So.
Did Machen then get a reputation for defending the Christian liberties?
No, Machen never entered into that.
Huh.
He never entered into that or the millennial question, either one of them.
Well, were some of the students then that were involved in this union and the independent board, you say there were some that were more, anti-Machen, you might say, and some?
Well, they were very much against Machen. This was 2 years before I left there. But then, when the attack strongly came against the independent board, then that became the big issue. And then, of course, they all thought Machen was a hero again. But this was the second year before his death, when they took that attitude. And, of course, the attitude that Van Til and some of these others were inculcating in them was the Presbyterian Church USA is a great big gathering of all sorts of views and everything, and we ought to have a pure church. And a pure church means that you're right, absolutely down the line on every doctrine, on every attitude of life, and so on. And so we want to stand for the gospel in the church and reach all we can for it. It's going to be wonderful when we get kicked out of the church because we can have a really pure church. And I heard one man who was in the independent board and was working hard to advance the cause that Dr. Machen was standing for. These students were looking down on Dr. Buzzler's and people like that. They were old fogies. They didn't know anything.
Why is that?
Well, because they had college work under them. Now they were taking more advanced courses. And they were having this tremendous influence on these particular doctrines, which had been taught to them, but without that tremendous emphasis on them. So they thought, well, what does he know? And, of course, they were when he sent so many of the students. And then the students would meet him and treat him like an ignoramus, you see. So they got very conceited in their ideas of what they knew. And, it was just as far as I was concerned, I was one lone influence, and like my emphasis was on the defense of the scripture. These other things didn't enter into my work at all. But I guess we better speak.
Well, these things that you're describing are the rumblings. They're really why you ended up leaving.
No, there was a rather dramatic event there. I'll tell you that another
time. Oh, okay. Well,
I didn't intend to leave.
Yeah, well, I realize where that's getting a little bit ahead, but I was wondering if this was some of the formation of the beginnings of the problems that led to that. I'm not sure that it's come. I'm not sure if it's entirely clear in the interview here whether why exactly the students opposed Machen.
They opposed Machen because he was cooperating with premillennialists and people with Arminian tendencies.
And those people were strongly, primarily influenced by Kuyper's thinking, Van Til and so forth.
Yeah, those students were.
The Dutch school.
Yeah.
But the irony in that to me is the Dutch school seems to be the more liberal culturally, liberties type guys, wanting to smoke and so forth, whereas Machen was more conservative in those areas.
This is interesting. Well, the thing came to a head, of course, when the General Assembly began moving against the members of the Independent Board. And all these men left, a lot of people left the Independent Board, and they wanted to find the substitutes, and the substitutes were premillennialists, because they were the people who were ready, willing to stand and take it. And in the end, it crystallized around, you might say, premillennialism was, the thing was, they were telling people, they were using me as a means of attracting students, and then using me as a means of getting money because of the fact I was a premillennialist, and then working the best they could to turn the students away from premillennialism. Now, I never would have resigned just for that. But that was one thing of the developing influence. Another thing they were doing was they were taking the stand that to stand for my Christian liberty to smoke and drink if I want is tremendously important. And when, in fact, after I left, there were students who went there who said, smoking is the sixth point of Calvinism. That naturally brought criticism and attack on them, which they didn't need to have. I was one time with the Van Til's host of dinner, and we went for a walk before dinner, and John Murray and I were guests. Well, Van Til says, let's sin a little bit. He says, let's smoke. So he brought out a cigarette for himself and Murray, and says, well, I was disgusted. I didn't say anything, but I thought I don't think you should speak that lightly about whether a thing is a sin or not. But if you did consider that it could be called a sin, why do it? I mean, I doubt Van Til hardly ever smoked. And Stonehouse, I think, smoked a fair amount. I don't know how much, but it was. He wouldn't smoke it. He felt he got to smoke, and he was very strong on his Christian liberty.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
So Van Til and Stonehouse were both very much supportive of the students in that Christian liberties issue?
Well, I don't know how much influence Van Til had, because his influence was mostly through his classes. And I know that in his classes he was a tremendous influence. He would find one fellow in the class who strongly disagreed with him, and he would make the man appear foolish to the whole class. And in the end, the fellow would usually adopt him. He would resist and resist and resist, and in the end he'd go wrong completely. And of course, Van Til, strong presuppositionalism. You presuppose the triune God. You presuppose the whole of Christianity, actually. You can't prove any of it. You just presuppose it. Well, the thing is, somebody said, what are you going to do then? Just make faces at the unbelievers. Well, he got this across to where... Wrong presuppositions. You presuppose the triune God. You presuppose the whole of Christianity, actually. You can't prove any of it. You just presuppose it. Well, the thing is, somebody said, what are you going to do then? Just make faces at the unbelievers. Well, he got this across to where, and I was giving, of course, in archaeology, giving evidences for the truth of the Old Testament. Paul spoke up. Why do we need to go into all these historical arguments? We've got the philosophic argument. Well, it's not going to turn people. I never heard anybody who was converted by that presupposition argument. But it gives to the man who already gives, it gives a wonderful feeling of confidence. We've got the truth. We don't have to worry about it. We've got the truth, and if you don't presuppose it to take it, you're just out. So it takes a little group and makes them more and more dogmatic instead of reaching out and winning the world for the Lord the way he wants us to.
It's interesting. Do you think there's any connection between the presuppositional ideas and the Christian liberties group?
Well, it was the same men, but whether there was any connection, I doubt.
It's like they wanted a little Christian elite country club where they could smoke and talk about philosophical ideas.
Yeah. And of course, Machen was utterly different. Utterly different. But when they did start a new church, then they got these little groups of very earnest Christians came together, left the big church to form a new church. And they'd have a man who just recently graduated, and he was... start telling him you've got to use fermented liquor for communion because it's not wine if it isn't Christ ordained wine. Well, with people,
it's October 20th, and Gloria and Steve Haig and Jim Pakula here, interviewing Dr. Alan A. McCrae. At approximately 10:45 a.m.
Well, I would say that probably the most interesting 2 years and a half of my life were the 2 years in Germany and Palestine and around there, 27 to 29, and then the summer of 31, because that was with a different culture and the experience is very new to me and very enjoyable, but probably not as interesting to others as other aspects of it. The happiest period of my life was probably the first 3 years at Westminster, with a close second being the first 15 years at Faith Seminary. There was a difference between those two experiences. The one at Westminster perhaps was the happier of the two because I didn't have much responsibility there. Well, I had a great deal of faith, of course. On the other hand, I had more freedom of faith, being in charge of just about everything. But it was the fellowship with the students, those 3 years. They came from strong Christian backgrounds, all the students. They were people who were interested, willing to come to a little institution just newly started with no prestige or anything. And, of course, the upper part of them were students who had been at Princeton and had left the prestige and background of Princeton and all that, and the pleas of many of their friends to come for this new venture. And I was free there to work ahead in the languages and to do within the limits of my particular area to do what I thought was interesting. And it was a very interesting time to me and a wonderful group of students, earnest Christians, active and wide awake and wanting intelligent training. So those 3 years, I'd say, were the were the probably the happiest of my life. And in contrast, the last 3 years at Westminster were the unhappiest of my life. Because it came on gradually. I didn't realize it was coming on. But I suddenly realized it was there. That the whole setup was changed. That the students, instead of being interested in winning souls for the Lord and standing for the great things of the gospel, were interested in fighting over what I considered very minor points of theology, and were interested in trying to advance a worked-out system with every little detail worked out, some of which are very clear in Scripture, and many of which are, I would say, human guesses, but an absolute rigid system like that, and their big interest being opposing those who differed with any slightest point of the system, rather than advancing the work of Christ. Now, that was the whole atmosphere, as I felt it, of the student body during my last 3 years there. And, of course, that came to clearest expression in the attitude toward Dr. Machen. Dr. Machen was interested in the great things of the gospel. He stood very definitely for the Reformed faith, and he was interested in carrying on the testimony of old Princeton, but his heart was in the great central issues and in standing for the Word of God against the terrible apostasy that was engulfing the Presbyterian Church in the USA. And so he was working along those lines and working with any who stood for the basic things of the gospel and were ready, wanted to advance the truth. Well, the next to last year that I was there, well, I should mention perhaps 2 or 3 years before the end, as I heard later, at the General Assembly, when they were making a stand for the independent board, and it was being attacked by those who feared that it would take all the money away from the foreign board of the church, that it looked, began to look as if they were going to lose. And then those who had been standing there for the right of the independent board to go ahead and do mission work without any connection with apostasy, when it looked as if they were going to lose, the group of them came together, and one man who was a fine preacher and a fine champion of the great essentials of the faith told how the group got together, and instead of being downcast at the way they were losing, the others were saying, "Oh, we're going to have a new church soon. We'll be able to make a perfect church now. We'll be able to stand right down the line on all these various points and name points," at which he either thought they were wrong or at least they weren't things to make a big fight over. And so instead of it being a time of drawing him together with them, it was a time of making him fear what might be ahead. Well, I didn't hear about that particular thing until later. But as I've mentioned, the second year before I left Westminster, Dr. Machen was working hard to build up the Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union, which was getting a lot of outstanding Christian laymen from all over the country, and they were going to make a big stand. And of course, the independent board was the point at which they were defending, but what they wanted was to have a really evangelistic, out-and-out Presbyterian church. And the student body was, I was amazed to hear the attitude they were taking about Dr. Machen. Dr. Carl McIntyre's brother was a student there, and he said, "I could just feel the hatred as all the students looked at me," because his brother was connected with this Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union, and he was standing with Dr. Machen. And all of it. Dr. Machen said, "Why don't they come to the PCCU meetings and make a stand for the Reformed faith, speak in favor of it?" He says, "We want to advance it." But he says, we're fighting the enemies of Christianity and we want to stand on the great issues. And instead of helping me, they're knifing me in the back. And he felt so strongly on it. And I began to see there the strength of that indoctrination, the way it had changed the students. A great number of students came from Wheaton College, and Dr. Buswell at Wheaton was doing all he could to get students to come to the seminary. And these students would come in, and after a year or two with Van Til and others, they would look down on what they'd gotten at Wheaton. They would think of that very one thing. They weren't making a big fuss about the limited atonement and fighting for that, and they were premillennialists, and they wouldn't allow them to smoke or drink there. And of course, that's Christian liberty. You're supposed to stand for Christian liberty to do what you want in those regards. And so Dr. Buswell would meet with these students. He was under charges because he was a member of the independent board. In fact, they had a big trial in the presbytery of Chicago and dropped him out, as they did Machen and others in the trials here. But these students were talking against him in that way. Well, what came, one thing that entered in, wouldn't need to have entered in, was a matter of premillennialism. Because most of the people at that time who were ready to really stand for the faith, not all by any means, but the overwhelming majority were very definitely premillennialists. And Dr. Machen got together the best group of people he could think of to stand out and out for the scripture in the PCCU, and the majority of them, or no, I mean in the independent board that he founded, and the overwhelming majority of them, well, I guess three-fourths of them, were premillennialists. They were people who were ready to really stand for the truth. And these fellows in the students in the seminary were coming to think premillennialism was almost next to was heresy. They were, the great thing for them was to fight against premillennialism, to fight against Arminianism, to fight against you mustn't tell anybody, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you can be saved, because after all, if you don't know who the Lord's elected, you can't say a thing like that to anybody. They can't believe unless the Lord enables them to. So the important thing is to get them to agree on that we must presuppose an absolute God. And when you say that, Van Til says he presupposes the triune God, the God of the Scripture. And that means you adopt the whole system, and exactly as they were taught it in their classes. Well, the difference in the student body, I just gradually came to feel. But those last 3 years, I frequently said to my mother, said, you know, I feel as if my life has just been utterly wasted. Now, as I said, premillennialism needn't have been an issue. Dr. Wilson used to say, I'm not a premillennialist, I'm not an amillennialist, I'm not a postmillennialist, I'm a millennialist. And by that, I took that he meant that he wasn't greatly excited about the details, but the fact that Christ was coming back was a great thing that the Apostle Paul looked forward to and talked about, and that most of the real Christians at that time were talking about. And the thing that irritated me was that I found out later that the representatives of the seminary were going, mostly to premillennialists, to get contributions, and they would say, well, now that school's not premillennialist, is it? No. Well, is it? What they'd say, the school doesn't take a stand on it. Well, we have two premillennialists in the faculty. We don't take any stand one way or the other on this. Well, Woolley never mentioned it in any of his classes, from what the students told me. And I was teaching beginning Hebrew, Arabic, and Babylonian, where those matters did not enter in at all. But for me to be put up as a thing to draw money, and then to have faculty members attacking it in their classes, Dr. Ellis would spend half the semester attacking premillennialism. I was told that he took one verse in Acts, which I think he misinterpreted. I wrote a whole article on it later. And he would spend nearly half a semester presenting that. And Dr. Alice, of course, was a great defender of the dependability of the Old Testament. But when he would speak against the higher criticism, the fellows would go to sleep. They all knew that was a bunch of junk. There was no truth to any of it. Why waste our time over that? After all, we presuppose the Bible. Why do we need to argue over that? As one fellow said in my class in archaeology, what's the use of all this historical evidence, he says? After all, we have the philosophical argument of Christianity. Well, the situation was, as I say, so that when we started a new church, instead of feeling enthused, as I would like to have felt, why, I felt as if we were getting into an atmosphere that I didn't feel at home. And, of course, the new class, people came out from the USA church, ready to start new churches, but then the students that took the churches were recent graduates, with the attacking premillennialism in the class and arguing for Christian liberty and depending on insisting on you had to have real wine. You couldn't use grape juice. Scripture says wine must be. Must be fermented, and fighting over these little things. And what should have been a great church as it would have been if they'd waited 20 years and then done it, and if they had done it on a standpoint of historic Presbyterianism instead of this narrow focus thing, would have been a tremendous church. As it was, people would come out and they would lose interest and they would drop away, and what should have been a big movement was starting to go downhill rather than ahead. And today, I've heard from friends who are in the PCA who have visited a meeting of the OPC, and they say that the way they argue about little points all the time, they say one meeting of it is about nothing for most of them. While the folks who are in this frame of mind, they just love this arguing over these little points. And, of course, I didn't like being used as a means of drawing money on account of me over a point which didn't enter into me and which they were attacking in their classes. And when I talked with the students, I would find that those who were attacking premillennialism were doing it from opposite viewpoints. Their views on eschatology were just as contrary to each other or more than they were to premillennialism. But that's what they were attacking. Well, I better take 10-minute rest and we continue there. Well, now, as to Dr. Machen, the hostility was terrible during the next to last year there. But then, when he was dropped from the church on account of his being in the independent board, then he was the great hero. And then he was interested in starting new churches and going here and there and bringing out people to start these new churches, which they called the Presbyterian Church of America. And he was, his last 3 months of his life, he was the great hero again. See, and that effaced that impression on people.
I see. Now, why was he attacked earlier? I mean, why
he was attacked because he was working with premillennialists and with people who might have some aspect of Arminianism, at least who thought that it was all right to call on people to be saved, not just wonder whether they'd been elected or not. And it was that attitude I wasn't familiar with before, but as I told you, how this fellow just could feel the hatred toward his brother, one of Dr. Machen's strongest supporters. And that was all. You see, the new church was started. Dr. Machen was the first moderator of it, and they were. Now everything was the USA church is utterly apostate. Anybody that stays in that is no good at all. And hardly any of the previous graduates of Westminster left the church. I must say that. The new graduates, there were very few that went back to the church of the new graduates. But of the former graduates, They mostly stayed in the church, though some of them had a real witness for the Lord, I must say, during years in it. But they never really, they were careful not to become objects of attack. They didn't support the Presbyterian Church of America or Dr. Machen.
Now, how did Dr. Machen handle these attacks? Did he know that there was animosity toward him among the students?
Yes, he said.
Did he think that was absurd?
He did. He was disgusted. He said, these students want to stand for the Reformed faith. That's great, he says. Why don't they come into the PCCU and make a talk on the importance of the Reformed faith? He says, that's fine. But he says, here we're trying to make a stand against apostasy, against denial of the word. And he says, they're attacking us. And, he was quite upset about it. But, of course, then when the action came down, these people were expelled, anybody who was in the independent church, in the independent board. And, of course, two-thirds of the members resigned from the board. And then they elected young recent graduates in their place. And what was I going to say? About Dr. Machen. The new church was started, and Dr. Machen was the moderator, and he was the great hero who was the martyr for the faith, who'd been unfrocked, you know, and so on. He was now a great hero, but it was for body. I don't know what the feeling had been before that year, because I only more or less accidentally heard of it. But during that year, it was very, very strong. And because they were emphasizing minor things instead of the majors, and I reached the conclusion that when people major on the minors, they're going to minor on the majors. And I knew people who could recognize a 1% mixture of Arminianism two blocks away, but could walk right up to a modernist and not see anything wrong in him. And it's a frame of mind that is not conducive to advancing the cause of Christ.
What happened to the PCCU?
It continued. They wanted, these folks were all disgusted. Dr. Machen and the others left it. They were disgusted that its members didn't all immediately leave the church and come to them, but there is at present, I understand, a strong group within the Presbyterian Church of laymen, which is trying to make a witness, and that may well be a continuation of it. I don't know. I haven't been in touch with those developments, but I know those people felt as if they'd been abandoned when at one point, anybody that leaves the church is premature. Then after this point, anybody that doesn't leave is wicked. And it just that one action. And as Dr. Allison said, a break over the independent board issue is going to be a splinter. It was not a thing that would arouse the interest of great numbers of people because it wasn't the major thing. And they, of course, the board, the foreign board was claiming to be sound, claiming they would not admit there was any modernism in it, though actually it was shot through. There's no question of that. Well, this result was that what should have been one of the happy times of my life, when we were free from the apostasy, we were out from it, we were starting a pure church and going to make a real testimony, to me was a time of sadness. Because I felt as if what should have been that was being blunted so that I couldn't see much future for it. I went along with them, and I was at the first assembly, and I did what I could to help. But I'd hear about this church that started off with 50 people, and then they said, we've got to use fermented liquor in the communion, and they preached constantly on what some of the people thought were comparatively minor issues, and they would church would dwindle. You know, it was, to me, a very, very frustrating time. And Dr. Boswell was the moderator the first time, and then the next assembly, Dr. Boswell was very active in promoting the church, new church, and Dr. Machen wanted them to elect Dr. Boswell as moderator. And the bulk of the people went along with him, but there were some of them who just wouldn't vote for Dr. Boswell. So they took one recent graduate and they nominated him. Boswell was elected overwhelmingly, but and this fellow was so embarrassed, he was very upset about it. But I was at a meeting. I was with John Murray and Murray Thompson, Murray Force Thompson, who was a lawyer, a young lawyer, and who was very active with that group, though not a seminary graduate. And I was with the two of them when they were talking about the independent board. And they said, oh, they said, that's a terrible board. They said, it's an awful board. They said, four-fifths of them are premillennialists, they said. And they said, there's a lot of them are dispensationalists, too, they said. Well, they went down the list. And there was about a fourth of, maybe a third, they thought were good men. But then they say, this one is a dispensationalist. This one, he's a premillennialist. This one's a dispensationalist. And from all I could see, the only difference was that the ones they called premillennialists rather than dispensationalists were people who, while being premillennialists, were thinking, this is wonderful, we're going to have a new church, we're living the apostasy and not saying much about it. While anybody who believed that premillennialism was true enough to advance it, they called them a dispensationalist. As far as I could see, that was the only real real difference. But they went down the list there, and I Dr. Alice left at the end of the next to the last year, and the result was I had the advanced courses to teach.
Why did he leave?
He left because, for one thing, he didn't leave the church. He thought it was premature to start the independent board. He thought that shouldn't have been done. And when he told Dr. Machen so after they started it, Dr. Hallis said, oh, he says, you shouldn't do this. He says, this is no issue to make a fight over. And Alice had made a big stand in presbytery on the big issues constantly. But Machen told him, so Alice says, Machen told him, he says, you can't interfere with my liberty. This is what I think I should do, and it's none of your business. And the attitude that Alice thought was, the seminary, they have no right to interfere with what they want to do that way. And then when the General Assembly began attacking it, and the board of the seminary included a lot of leaders of big churches and people, and a substantial number of premillennialists. Dr. Machen said the last year is like last 6 months before the start. He said the board should tell us and tell the world whether they board of the seminary, whether they stand with the independent board or whether they're against. And some of the members of the board said they were disgusted. They said we weren't even allowed to discuss it. The board, this is something that this was done. They had nothing to do with the seminary. Now we're told the seminary's got to stand with it, or they're going to get out. And so they brought a paper for the faculty to sign, to present to the board, saying that the board must take a stand for the seminary board, for the independent board. And John Murray didn't think that was the thing that the seminary faculty should do. And he didn't sign it. I didn't think it was. And I didn't sign it. And Dr. Alice felt very strongly and he didn't sign it. So the other four members, of course, all signed it. And some on the board said, well, one man there said, I never saw such a thing done in business, such an unscrupulous thing as it looks to me, he says. And some began to say, well, four members of the faculty take this attitude that the other three don't. Let's keep the three and lose the four. Well, of course, that was ridiculous. And Dr. Machen came to us and he says, won't you sign something, the three of you, so we'll see the faculty is united. They made a statement that John Marie and I could sign without any problem. But Dr. Alice, of course, resigned. This was after he had resigned. And in the end, 60% or more of the members of the seminary board resigned, and they elected a lot of recent graduates of the seminary that would do whatever they told them. And Mrs. Alice said, she says, we're having a youth movement. She says, we're having a youth movement. But, yeah.
History never.
What's that?
I never heard this history.
No, it's not generally talked about. Well, that's one thing. We started faith. We did not engage in any polemics, none at all. We made no attacks. I made a strong, clear statement of why I was leaving. And that was in the paper, the front page of the Philadelphia paper. And that's all I ever said. I made a clear, definite statement going into detail. And that was it. And we never criticized them. We went ahead, worked constructively. And when I left faith, we did the same thing. Dr. McIntyre issued a little pamphlet. My secretary, Miss Trettig, went through it. She found 35 things she thought were errors in the statements. So I never made it. And you never heard me criticize Dr. McIntyre.
Now, do you have a copy of that statement that was on the front page of the Philadelphia paper somewhere in your files? That would be good to have in the archives.
It was reprinted. I got a feeling it's in Ryan's book. I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it is or not.
Ryan's. You've mentioned his book before.
Yeah.
Which one was that?
The Presbyterian Conflict.
Oh, yes. Now, I'll check on that. Did you leave a year after, Doctor? Could you describe, we didn't really touch on the Dutch school yet. Maybe we can wait for another week. But at one point, I think we should focus in on your departure.
Yep.
You've given a tremendous background to it, which has really helped me, because I always kind of wonder, well, why did they do that?
Sure.
And I understand that better now.
Yeah, I felt my life was just being wasted.
I really understand that in a way that I never did. And it's much to your credit that you never hammered on that either and made it a big thing that everybody had to know. But on the other hand, it makes me much more supportive of your step at that time, which I kind of heard more from the other side, frankly. And I'd like to really spend time in the interview, either now or next week, on that transitional year or two, when you actually came to that point of seeing that it would be good to launch out. Who was sharing this with you, how it happened, and so on. If you'd like now to go back more to the comment on the Dutch influence, although maybe you did this earlier with Steve when the two of you interviewed alone.
Well,
and we don't want to take too much of your time either.
I might say a word about the Dutch. They used to say in Germany, you go into Poland and those countries, everything is filthy, they said. You come to Germany and everything is sensibly clean. You go to Holland and you can eat your breakfast off the floor of the cow sheds. In other words, the Dutch have a tendency to be very thorough. Whatever they're for, they have to be very, very much so. And I think they have a tendency to fight over little points, too. I think these perhaps are national tendencies. I don't know. But it was Dr. Van Til and Stonehouse, and particularly Kuiper, who were the ring leaders in this whole attitude, and except that Kuiper, well, he didn't think much of the other Dutchmen as individuals, but he had the characteristic they had and the same feelings. And there are many very, very fine Dutch people, but I have to confess that when I left Westminster, I had kind of a feeling I'd just as soon not have a lot more to do with Dutchmen. And the next year I went to Wheaton to try to get students for faith and spoke in chapel there, and Dr. Stamp, who was as Dutch as anybody ever could be, he was head of their conservatory of music, and he just helped me so much and was so nice and everything. I said to him, I said, "Oh, Dr. Stamp, I'm thankful to the Lord for having at this time brought me into this contact with such a nice Dutchman, because," I said, "after my recent experiences, I could easily have developed a dislike of Dutch people." And it was just a fine offset to that. Yes?
One time I asked you what you thought of the Dutch art, and you said that it was too flat, that you liked the Italian art better, and I was wondering if that carried over into your appreciation of their art.
Well, I like Rembrandt, of course, very much. But you know, when Rembrandt, you know, they had pictures of different groups of people, they all stand so in line, you know, it's all so formal. And the group of people in, there was a society which asked to have Rembrandt paint a picture of them. They couldn't make photographs in those days, so they had to get a picture. So he, instead of having them stand up in line and everything, he had them get into a rather informal pose, you know, and made a picture, and they were disgusted. Yes, you want to answer? You were the one to answer.
Well, I told them to read.
They were disgusted with this more.
Oh, they were disgusted with it, and somebody stuck it in the kitchen of the place. I think there was some argument whether they should even pay him for his effort. You know, he died in poverty, Rembrandt did. And they say the smoke from the kitchen kind of darkened the thing. And so when Rembrandt began to be famous and people were hunting for his works, they found this work and they says, "Oh, look at that. We call it the Night Watch." So they call it the Night Watch, and it's one of his great pictures. But the people he made it of, I understand, didn't like it at all because of its artistic, informal arrangement instead of the stern 1, 2, 3, 4 that seemed to them to be more orderly. Yeah, the thing of Rembrandt dying in poverty is really sad.
Did you ever have much contact with Dr. Van Til after you left Westminster?
Yeah, not a great deal.
What was it like?
Oh, very pleasant. Dr. Van Til was a very pleasant man. And he was a real Christian, too. He loved the Lord. And that's one thing that kept me back from making things as clear as I should through the years. I liked him personally, I always did. Mm. I had a few runs in with him. Short time before I left, Dr. Buzzell was taking a stand on these things I mentioned, and Dr. Buzzell was naturally irritated at the way his students that he urged so to come to Westminster thought they were so superior to him and thought he was wrong on so many things. Dr. Van Til told me once, he says, "Now," he says, "this is what I hold." And he talked for over an hour to me. He said, "Now," he showed how there were the philosophic movements and there was the answer, and there was philosophical answer. And finally it reaches the present point of he's got the answer. This is the answer. Well, I said, "What about the next thing that comes philosophically?" Oh, he says, "What could it be? What else could there be?" But he was talking, telling me about this philosophy of theology, you know, and every 3 minutes in the course, he would say, what does Buswell know about the Reformed faith? And he'd go on expounding it to me. He was a nice fellow. He brought a friend up to, after we started here, he brought a friend up to see our property and show him around.
I remember hearing about that, yeah.
Oh, yes, and then...
He was happy at your enterprise.
Oh, yes. And then there was a girl who had some connection with the InterVarsity in Canada. She wrote a book on the scripture, Miss Cameron, Viola Cameron.
Oh, yeah.
And she took spent some time at Westminster once, and she phoned me and wanted to talk with me, which I saw her and her mother and talked with them. Well, then this was some years after that. She came and spent a semester here, you may remember.
Yeah.
And she wanted to see Dr. Van Til. So he'd written a nice introduction to her book, I think. And so I got in touch with him, and he invited us to dinner. So I drove her down to where he lived, and he says, we'll be going, and he took us to a stand-up restaurant, you know, a cafeteria. She didn't know what cafeteria was or how to utilize it, but we went there and ate together and then sat around and talked, and we had a real nice time.
She was an extremely artsy sort of unusual person.
Especially
I remember
at the end of her life. Then, yes,
at least when she was here.
Yeah.
You know, just very, you could tell she was very... a lot to her, very unusual, and kind of spacey in certain ways.
Yeah. And we had no women students then, so she was kind of isolated.
I remember a story once, I'm not sure if it was Dr. Vannoy, but I think it might have been, who said that he met Van Til one day when the building was still boarded up.
Yeah.
And he says he came up and he saw something. He heard somebody in the building doing something. He waited and somebody came crawling out. I guess you get out somehow. It must have been an opening. I don't know if the doors were open or whatever at that time. But he says it was Van Til. And was that something?
Yeah. Well, he was a real nice fellow. That was part of his asperity. Always showed, I think, in the classes where he could make a fellow seem like a fool to all the rest of them who argued against him. And sometimes the man would argue against him for 3/4 a year. And, of course, the arguing with the professor, the students naturally tend to support the professor. And then in the end, the student would come around. And one student who was a graduate of Yale, who argued with him, told me, he says, he's wrong on this presupposition. So he's completely wrong. He argued with him 3/4 a year, and then the fellow swung over and adopted it completely. And he not only adopted it, he carried it further than Van Til would. Because if you presuppose the whole Christian faith, the God, the triune God and everything, why not presuppose that God gave us manuscripts that are free from error? So he wrote a book called The King James Version Defended. His name was Hills. And he says in the beginning, it isn't the King James Version, it's the Texas Receptus.
And interestingly enough, a recent issue, just the last issue or so of the Christian Century, has one of the best articles I've seen on Reconstructionism.
Yeah.
And it mentions Van Til denying that he is a Reconstructionist.
Yeah.
But it mentions how many of his disciples have advanced this movement.
Yeah.
And it's actually a restrained article. It doesn't just lambast these people as a bunch of crazies.
Sure, sure.
But, which, you know, sometimes evangelical articles on it do, and I think rightfully so to some degree. But it's a very informative in that way. I'll try to see you get a copy, but it's amazing that they try to kind of detect it back to Van Til in certain ways.
Yeah, it's carrying his teaching to a point he never would have carried it to. As Hills did on the virgins, the Reconstructionists all looked at presuppositionalism as a part of their doctrine.
Maybe it's the next point.
Oh, they're a danger or something.
Oh, they are, yes.
It mentions the fellow Joseph Moorcraft, who I have a lot of respect for. He was on my ordination and licensure examining committee in Westminster Presbytery. He later left the PCA because it wasn't reformed enough.
Oh, yeah.
But he ran for Congress and got a third of the vote, and he was very active in yeah. in these circles.
And it wasn't reformed enough for him, the old PCA.
No, yeah. The PCA.
The PCA?
No,
oh,
it wasn't reformed enough.
Yeah.
It's amazing how even the names of churches play in. There was, in Atlanta, there was the Rock of Ages Presbyterian Church and the Chalcedon Presbyterian Church, and Chalcedon was his.
Yeah.
And but just even the two names indicate different approaches to the theology. The Rock of Ages Church was they call us the evangelicals. That's another thing that concerns me at Westminster, even today. Denise says they don't identify themselves as evangelicals. This is speaking mainly to some of the students and so on. Yeah. It's those evangelicals.
Yep.
Yeah. And I've seen this in the PCA, too. Like Moorcraft would say, well, the evangelicals are going to win that vote.
Well, what do they call themselves?
They're the Reformed. Okay. See, they're the ones with the true theology. And these others are, well, they're just evangelicals.
Sure.
And they're the masses, you know, that don't understand, you know. That.
And I think it's so important that the great truths of the Reformed faith, they are a comfort. They are a help to us. They are a tremendous value. What the thing to do is